Hello and welcome to A Little Less Conversation, a podcast series on how Australia is addressing climate change as a function of our international development program. I'm Dermot O'Gorman, CEO of WWF Australia.
And I'm Rachel Nunn, founder of Goodwill Hunters Podcast and director with Mandala Partners. This series is a collaboration between WWF, ACFID and Goodwill Hunters.
Today, climate change is the stormy undercurrent in our everyday lives. And here in Australia, like many countries around the world, we work as development practitioners to allow an urgent drumbeat about urgent action on climate change. So for development action to be effective, it's increasingly obvious that we need to address climate change, and it needs to be front and centre of our strategies and plans and policies.
And to that end, we're holding the microphone out to those willing to take on the sometimes vexed challenge of speaking to Australia's climate change and development goals, where they intersect and where they deviate, as well as profiling innovative themes and ideas. And what we're saying is if you're not centering the environment right now in your future plans, you should be.
So the shape of the Australian Parliament has dramatically changed during the last election. Some have said it was in part a climate election. And the parliament is dominated not only by two major parties, but we have a much broader and diverse group of independents than ever before. So those independents include doctors, business people, former CEOs, foreign affairs correspondents, but of course amongst them, and they're all high achievers, is our ex-Wallaby David Pocock.
David is a senator for the Australian Capital Territory and, as Dermot said, is a former professional rugby player, at one time captaining the Australian rugby union team, the Wallabies. We're actually not inviting him on, though, because we're big rugby union fans.
We are big rugby union fans, though, Rachel. It's okay. We can be
about that. Yeah. Yeah, we are. But mostly we're inviting him on because he's extremely relevant to our sector. The senator has always used his platform to call for social change, and in 2020, he and his brother Stephen co-founded Rangelands Restoration Trust, a regenerative agriculture project working to build nature-based climate solutions, adaptation and resilience in rural southern Zimbabwe, where David grew up. In his short time in Parliament, the senator has made inroads into forging strong people-to-people links, particularly in the Pacific, and most recently he made headlines for taking the climate fight to Parliament. Senator, welcome.
Hi, Rachel and Dermot. Great to be with you.
David, we might just jump into a very topical subject here in Australia at the moment, which is deforestation and native forests. And about a month ago, you and I shared a helicopter ride over Tallaganda in southern New South Wales to look at deforestation and native forest logging and the destruction that was going on there. Can you talk a little bit about that link between the importance of trees, climate action, and the unfortunate fact that Australia is the only country in the world, a developed country in the world, that is a deforestation nation?
During the last election campaign, we obviously heard a lot about climate, and I'd argue that Labor were elected with a mandate for bold climate action. Climate change went from this thing out there that scientists are warning us about, we know we should be concerned about, to with the bushfires in 2019-20 that all Australians saw. This is the reality that we're facing, and Australians want action. And whilst we're hearing a lot about the transition to renewables, which is an important part of that, I'm really concerned that the part that Labor and most politicians in there don't want to talk about is to stop doing the things that don't make any sense and are making things worse. Approving new fossil fuel projects and continuing native forest logging, something that's costing taxpayers money, it's unprofitable, and yet we're cutting down these incredible stores of carbon and really important habitat in a biodiversity crisis. We know that we're the world's leaders when it comes to extinction. So we've got to stop doing silly things like continuing to cut down native forests, which are important habitat and are important for holding that carbon.
I guess to circle back a little bit, we're always interested in how people's early life or pre-parliament life shaped the goals and values that they brought to parliament. And my partner is Zimbabwean and talks a lot about how growing up in Zimbabwe as a country with very frequent power outages shaped some of his views and his vision for his career. I'd be interested in how your upbringing in Zimbabwe prepared you for Parliament and also how your rugby career prepared you for Parliament.
Sure. Yeah, that's good to hear that you, you're with the Zimbabwean. They're everywhere. I mean, the Zimbabwean diaspora just across the world. And that was one of the things, you know, playing rugby for Australia, you'd travel to Argentina, the UK, everywhere you went, you'd meet Zimbabweans doing their thing across the world, given what happened to Zimbabwe. And yeah, power outages just aren't a thing. You know, the power goes off and no one really blinks blinks an eye. You just kind of get on with things. But it's certainly shaped, you know, I think those early years do shape you. And I was really lucky to grow up on a farm and had, you know, dad and a grandfather who were passionate about nature and birds and really found the natural world endlessly fascinating, spent a lot of time outdoors, and had also heard stories from my dad about what things were like when my grandfather first started farming there, and then what things were like when my dad was growing up. And clearly there were changes in the landscape and different species that used to be there, you know, I wish I could have seen as a kid. And that kind of got me thinking about the changes that were happening. And then I guess moving, we lost our farm in Zimbabwe. It was taken from us in the land redistribution program. And we're lucky enough to move to Australia as skilled migrants. My mum was a school teacher and essentially started here again. And I think like any migrant, it's a process of getting to know this new land and ultimately really falling in love with it. It's just such an incredible continent. Truly astonishing. The landscapes, the biodiversity, you know, we're a mega diverse country and extraordinarily wealthy. And yet we don't have a great track record of looking after it. And I found that really troubling comparing, you know, some of the efforts that happen in places like Southern Africa, where conservation and sort of this environmental land ethic seem to transcend the political spectrum. We're moving to Australia and finding it strange, like the idea that only, you know, greenies or tree huggers cared about the environment was something that was really new to me. That just hadn't been my experience growing up. So I think that certainly shaped the way I thought about, you know, caring for the place that we live. I think it's ultimately self-interest to want to look after the place you live and depend upon. And then rugby clearly shaped me too. Like as a kid, I was 9 or 10 when South Africa won the 1995 Rugby World Cup, and it's just seared into my memory as an incredible moment. And I just remember the amount of joy that it brought to the people around me, and that's what I wanted to do since I was a kid. And you know, was really fortunate enough to do that. And it was a childhood dream, something that I loved and something that I really tried not to take for granted, and to use whatever platform I had to talk about other issues that I thought were important and stay involved in things like community development work in Zimbabwe or speaking up about climate and environmental issues. And then when I retired and you kind of feel like, well, I've spent thousands of hours on all these skills, which are now pretty useless. But you start to do other things and you realize just how many great skills sport does give you, from working hard, setting goals, being part of a team, being able to take on feedback and try to get better. So yeah, those two things certainly shaped who I am today.
And so David, just to build on that early experience on farms and in nature, and your comment, which I'll paraphrase, around the polarization of farming here between greens and, you know, farmers, which, having worked around the world on sustainable farming, you know, in many other countries, is not there, resonates with me as well. So you've recently set up with your brother something called the Rangelands Restoration Trust around regenerative agriculture. Could you talk a little bit about that? I'm assuming that journey you've been on has led you towards that establishment of this trust, and tell us a little bit about what it's trying to do.
I left school in 2005 and started playing professional rugby the next year. And a few years after that, got involved back in Zimbabwe working with a local NGO on community development work. And for about a decade, we helped raise funds here. We were involved in, you know, helping look at the program and working with local partners to implement what I think were great projects that it's still going. We handed it over to a big NGO. One of the things that kept coming up through my eyes with interest in agriculture is that so many of the interventions weren't addressing some of the root causes of some of the poverty, land degradation, and a lack of access to markets. And it's something that's really fascinated me is the intersection of community development work and working with communities, conservation and agriculture, because a lot of these communities live in incredible landscapes and they pay the price of living next to wildlife, things like elephants, hyena, leopard, either eating their crops, eating their livestock, and really wanting to try and develop models that worked for communities to live alongside them. And so it was many years in the thinking and making. And yeah, my youngest brother's been involved in community development work in Papua New Guinea, and started COVID, he actually moved in with his partner and I, moved in with my wife and I here in Canberra, and we got talking about this project and moved over in 2021. It's called Rangelands Regeneration now. We had a name change a couple of years ago, but really is working with communities on better livestock management, access to markets to try and get more offtake, and then working across about a 70,000 hectare area that has, you know, a lot of elephant and some pretty special wildlife, really trying to come up with solutions. How do you ensure that people, and particularly, you know, these communities, you talk about climate change, they're on the front lines. This is semi-arid rangelands, highly variable rainfall, and they simply don't have the funds to adapt. And so we're looking at ways to try and make both the landscape and their enterprises more resilient to climate change. It's a really you know, complex problem, but a really exciting one to be part of and to be working with communities there.
It would be good to unpack that a little bit more, because we talk so much about community adaptation as though it's always possible. And you talk about these communities that you've worked with in Zimbabwe being at the front line of climate change. And can you elaborate a bit on what that means on a day-to-day basis? Like, in what ways are they experiencing the impacts of climate change already?
I remember being out at a community development project. It was probably 2010. And we'd been doing some interviews at one of the local schools, kind of sort of assessing one of the programs that had been happening. And we were just sitting, it was stinking hot before the summer rains. And I was sitting with one of the community development workers, Paul Kanye. He called himself Kanye East because he wasn't Kanye West. And we were chatting, and then he kind of, the mood kind of just shifted. And he said, you know, David, one of the biggest fears for me in my community is that it's people like you and where you live in Australia that are making this problem of climate change. We're not contributing to it, and yet we have no resources to deal with it. And they're seeing rivers that they've relied on for a long time run dry, their yields become more unreliable, and there's no services and all the things that, you know, drought relief that Australians rely on. It's those communities. They've got to figure it out. And they know things are changing, but what do you do? That's where you're from. That's where you live. That's where you have land. And so really trying to ensure that, I guess we're planning for this, that land is being managed in a way that it is more resilient, that when you do get rainfall, that there's ground cover, so you get better infiltration and better use of that rainfall. Because one of the things that, you know, you're seeing in a lot of these semi-arid rangelands is because of land degradation, when you do get rainfall, there's flooding because it's not very effective. There's no ground cover. It's going straight into the rivers. There's a lot of erosion. They are often on their own. And you know, the other side of that, when they have floods, they're then dealing with not just the flooding, but lack of access to fresh water. So there's cholera outbreaks. This is the world that they know that we're going into. They're experiencing it. They're seeing it in their communities, and they're talking about adaptation, but many don't have the resources for that. And you know, I think that's potentially why we see this disconnect here in Australia. When people talk about loss and damage, it sometimes doesn't mean much in Australia, but for developing countries, it's so important. They're desperate for it to start investing now.
Yeah. I mean, you paint a picture of extreme resource scarcity and powerlessness in many ways, which, as you say, I think is missing from the discussion often on adaptation, where we paint adaptation as a choice, whereas they're just adapting, like, because by virtue of having to, but without a lot of the resources that are required to adapt, really. And I think the question it raises for me is, as an independent senator, what does this mean for you? What do you see as your responsibility in terms of raising these issues in the parliament?
As independent, I see my role as raising the concerns of my community. And we know that people in the ACT want bold climate action. They are concerned about, you know, the long history of denial and then delay in Australian climate politics. And now we've got a government that's saying the right things, that they're talking about the transition. At the same time, they're approving new coal mines, they're approving gas projects, and that they're talking about continuing to expand the fossil fuel industry at a time when climate scientists every few days there's another article with climate scientists urging us to act. And so my role really is to continue to push the government at every turn to take this seriously and to tell the truth about what we're facing. Because I think that's one of the things that we're seeing is we're not hearing the truth from politicians. We hear them throw around adaptation, and at the same time, the IPCC is saying, listen, adaptation is extremely, extremely difficult, if not impossible, over 2 degrees warming. It's going to be so hard to adapt to that. And that we've got a government that kind of, you know, in the intergenerational report, you just kind of put it in there, oh, we're going to have to adapt in these costs in the future. Like, this is serious. We've got a window to act now. And so it's pushing them every turn, and then it's finding ways to introduce legislation that highlight the need to act. And one of the things that done there is introduce a bill that would legislate a duty of care to young people and future generations. We had the previous government argued that they didn't have a duty of care to young people. I wasn't a politician then, but I remember being furious that we had a government that thought that they could argue that they didn't have to think about young people when they made these decisions. Like, if politicians aren't here to make decisions that are good for young people, what's it all for? Like, we should just pack up and go home. Like, that's got to be part of our decision-making process, but it's not. And so, yeah, I'll be pushing that. It's currently in front of a Senate committee, and we'll hopefully debate it next year.
Can we just unpack that a little bit more? Because you put that, I think, over the winter into Parliament as a proposal. So can you just unpack a couple of things? First of all, you know, how do we make sure that the health and well-being in the broader sense of young people is brought into legislation? And the second piece is, because we can't just pack up and go home, and young people can't pack up and go home, how do we give them their voice more power into this process in order for them to really get much more involved in designing the future that they're going to inherit long after we're all gone?
A few years ago, Anjali Sharma and a group of young Australians took the former environment minister to court, arguing that she had a duty of care to them when it came to approving fossil fuel projects, and they won. The government then appealed that and argued that they didn't in fact have a duty of care, and the government won. But in the decision, the court said that we believe this is up to the parliament, not the judiciary. And so talking to Anjali Sharma and young people said, well, let's make it the parliament's responsibility. Let's legislate a duty of care to young people when ministers or delegated decision makers are making those decisions. And so the bill really is really simple. You know, I'm concerned about short-term decision-making across the board in parliament. It's rife. I think it's something we've got to talk about more and we've got to change. But this bill is very much just focused on the climate side of things. And so when someone goes to make a decision that will have a material impact on the climate through emissions, they've one, got to assess the impact that it'll have on young people and future generations, which you could say, yeah, that's great, but that's potentially just a boxing exercise. Secondly, they can't proceed if it does. And I really think that's where we're up to when it comes to climate change and what we need to do. We've got to stop doing the dumb things like opening up new fossil fuel projects, given what the climate is doing. And so we're hoping through the submission process and through the community hearings to hear from young people. We know how hard it is for young people. You turn on the news and there's another climate disaster and people are thinking, well, this is my future. I'm young. I've got my whole life ahead of me. What's my future going to be like? You older people, you've had it great. You've had this mostly stable climate and look at what we're inheriting. And it's hard not to, I think being anxious is probably the right response, to be honest, but it's what do you do with that? And I think being able to say to young people, hand on heart, we are going to do everything we can to make your future as good as it possibly can be. And we're going to join with you in doing that. I think that's a powerful thing, and that will go some way to helping actually listen and empower young people.
Yeah, absolutely, David. And you talk to grandparents, their grandchildren are their most important thing. And so you'd think that this would also talk to older Australians to say, you need to get behind this too. So, but I might hand to you, Rachel, for the next question, because we might take it a little bit offshore.
Yes. And another region where we see young people really stepping up as advocates and being vocal is the Pacific. And you gave a speech to the Australia Institute earlier this year where you talked about the need for bolder action for our Pacific neighbours. What did you mean by that, and what does that look like for you?
In Australian rugby, just over 50% of players have Pacifica heritage. So yeah, every team has a heap of players from, Samoa or Tonga, Fiji. And so, spending time with Pacific Islander players changed my life, honestly. Like, you have teammates like that and you see what family means to them. They're all about family and the kind of care and energy and love that they bring to teams is quite extraordinary. And I think, talk to anyone who's been in a rugby team with players who have Pacific heritage, and they'll tell you a similar story. And so I remember being a rugby player, talking to, say, my Fijian Australian teammates who talk about their home village having to find higher ground for cropping because the land's becoming too salty, becoming saline. And then you've got an Australian government going on about how, we're part of the Pacific family and all this kind of stuff. And it just doesn't square. If you want to know what family means, look how people in the Pacific actually treat their families. They don't say that and then go and approve new fossil fuel projects when they know that that is going to be an existential threat for those nations. And, we know it already is. We know that we've locked in a huge amount of damage. And if we're serious about it, we've got to make some tough decisions in Australia that aren't going to be popular with the fossil fuel industry. And yeah, it's been really frustrating to see Australian politicians talk about the Pacific family and then not listen to Pacific Island nation leaders when it comes to bold climate action. And I really think that we need to step up as a country.
Yeah. And when we call for bold climate action, what are some tangible things that you would like to see Australia do?
Stopping approving new fossil fuel projects is probably the first step. when you find yourself in a hole, you stop digging if you want to try and get out of it.
How can Australians across the, you know, the diversity of Australia, how can they rally perhaps more around the Port Vila call? What do you think would be a good way to better build that family connection with the Pacific in a way that's real and meaningful?
One of the things that's really sobering getting into Parliament is seeing the influence of the fossil fuel industry, where you have both the major parties essentially wheeling out fossil fuel talking points about the need for more gas when we export 75% of our gas. But at the same time, the thing that politicians care about the most is being reelected. And so if people are saying to them, listen, you have to make this your priority. You've got to be acting on climate. We're going to hear more and more politicians listening, and we're going to see more agitation within the major parties to take it seriously. And so I would say, get in touch with your local member, tell them how much it means to you, and tell them that this will be decisive when you go to the next federal election and cast your vote. I think that makes a difference. But yeah, I don't know. It's a really hard thing to see when we're making these decisions that don't square with looking after ourselves and the region as a whole that we know is so susceptible to climate change, you know, rising sea levels, more intense storms, storm surges, and you know, Pacific Island nations already seeing the effect, and some of them already planning for what happens when we have to relocate parts of our islands.
You've played many games of rugby in the Pacific, David, and I think you have a big fan base there. Any thoughts about going to the Pacific in the foreseeable future to talk to, you know, those people on the front line that you talked about earlier?
I'd love to. I mean, yeah, love playing against Pacific Island nations over the years. To be honest, Australia doesn't play them enough, and certainly doesn't play in those countries enough. I remember playing Fiji with Australia A in 2007, maybe. But yeah, don't play enough. I'd love to get out. We've got so much time for the style of rugby and just the toughness that the Pacific Islander nations bring to the game.
It's funny, after about 10 years of working in the Pacific now, the reason I can name a lot of rugby league and rugby union players is not because I've watched a lot of games, I'll be honest, but because of all of the taxi drivers I've had throughout Pacific Island countries who name them.
Yeah.
And you realize that it's like critical to conversation and bonding. And it's a bigger picture reminder of the power of sport as a tool in our diplomatic toolkit. And I think that, as Dermot said, David, your recognition and sort of fan base, for want of a better phrase, in the Pacific is a really powerful tool that you have in connecting with communities. And we actually mentioned that we were interviewing you to one of our colleagues in Fiji, and her eyes lit up when your name is mentioned. And she asked, and I paraphrase, she asked that you continue to use your voice and your position to argue with governments for action on behalf of all of the local communities in the Pacific, and in particular women who often don't feel heard and who bear a disproportionate part of the climate impact. How does hearing that make you feel?
Thanks, Rachel. Yeah, I mean, there's just so much work to do. You know, I think it's recognizing Australia's role in the Pacific. One, we've got to sort ourselves out when it comes to our emissions, because we hear so many politicians talk about, oh, you know, we're a small country, we really don't matter, it's all about China. But this is about leadership. This is about looking at our per capita emissions, which are right up there, some of the highest in the world, and then grappling with the fact that we are one of the biggest fossil fuel exporters in the world. We clearly have a role to play, and us taking this seriously will have a, you know, an outsized effect on not only reducing emissions, but in terms of leadership. And then I'd argue that that has to flow on to our engagement with the Pacific when it comes to aid and development, looking at adaptation, you know, working with countries so that they can themselves transform some of their energy systems away from expensive diesel that's being used, but then also look at solutions like what does it mean for more intensive cyclone seasons for building and for all sorts of things. And communities usually know their problems best, so it's about listening and then genuinely partnering with them to ensure that those solutions happen and are funded and built. So I think it's a huge opportunity. We're hearing a lot from the government about pivoting back towards the Pacific. You could argue that we've probably dropped the ball there for a while, but that engagement has to be genuine, and it has to be a genuine partnership and not this paternal way of doing aid and development that I think unfortunately we've seen for a while now in many places across the world.
So David, maybe just to start to wrap up, and I mean, you talked about, I think that global leadership role that Australia could play. And look, there are some very positive things that the recent international development policy that DFAT put out requires over the next few years, 80% of all projects that DFAT scored to have a climate lens attached to it and a climate action, which is a very positive thing. And does start to, for Australia to start to maybe step up more into a leadership role. Any sort of messages for the rest of the world about, how Australia needs to really step up and how it can play that leadership role? That'd be really interesting to hear from you.
I think credit's where it's due. Minister Wong has done a great job in engaging in the Pacific. She's traveled a lot, meeting with leaders, and with the changes to the way that Australia is going to do aid and development, I think they've really welcome. And I think there's a lot of great work has gone into developing them. Obviously got to now deliver them. And hopefully this translates to the way that we are interacting and dealing at places like COP. We know how important that is to reach global consensus on climate and what different countries individually are going to do, but then globally what the effort is going to be. And we know as Australians, we've got a pretty shameful record there. It's very well reported how obstructionist and how much damage has been done over the years with Australia watering things down and sort of siding with other big fossil fuel exporters to reduce ambition. That needs to change. If we're serious about what we say about the Pacific, and if we're serious about climate action and becoming a renewable energy superpower, which we hear a lot about, this is where it matters to actually step up and show that leadership. And I think it's important, and I'm looking forward to seeing what the government does do around COP.
And David, on the financing front of that, in terms of support for developing countries to both deal with the energy transition and build resilience, thoughts on Australia, making a fair contribution into, financing loss and damage and measures. Any thoughts on that?
I went up to COP in Glasgow for Rangelands Regeneration, trying to meet people there and try and raise a bit of money for some of the work that we were doing, and met with a number of developing countries. And that was one of the biggest concerns, is that there's been a lot of talk about finance for the transition, a lot of talk about commitments for a loss and damage fund, but they just haven't materialized to the extent that they've been promised. And so I think there absolutely is a very strong argument that wealthy countries like Australia have to be stepping up. We've got an obligation as wealthy countries who've benefited from the fossil fuels that have created this problem to assist and stand alongside developing countries who are still dealing with a whole bunch of issues that are really no longer issues. Granted, there are Indigenous communities in Australia that I would argue have been left behind, but there's absolutely a role for Australia to step up. We've got to be honest with where we're at and then chart a course forward, because we have this incredible opportunity, to be here now, to know what we know about the problem, to have the solutions at hand, and to know that it's doing it. It's political will and making this happen. And we know that when humans truly set their mind to something, you know, we're capable of extraordinary things. So there is still this narrow window to limit warming to, you know, 1.5 to below 2 degrees. It's slim, but it's there, and we've got to be going for it and doing absolutely everything we can. And I think that's really exciting. This is what we'll be judged on by future generations, and it's going to take a big effort from everyone.
Senator, I think that's a great way to wrap up. We've just got to go for it. So thank you so much for your time today. We've been Rachel Mason Nunn. I'm Dermot O'Gorman, and this has been a little bit less conversation. Thanks so much. Tune in again. Goodbye for now.